Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subjects and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of March 31st, 2025. What do you got for us, Tom?
All right, kicking it off today, we have a article from Elastic Security titled Outlaw Linux Malware: Persistent, Unsophisticated, and Surprisingly Effective. So general overview, Outlaw is a Linux-based malware that, despite its simplicity, has managed to persist and spread effectively. It primarily utilizes an SSH brute force attack to gain access to systems with weak credentials. Some of the kind of infection process it takes, initial access is gained, again, by leveraging that SSH brute force, generally targeting systems with the default credentials or password spraying for weaker credentials. The malware then initiates attacks by downloading a malicious script that a SSH shell script that retrieves a compromised gzip package from a command and control server. Pretty typical stuff. But upon execution, the main initialization script, which is identified as initall.sh, is executed, leading to the deployment of various malicious components. So this includes establishing itself in hidden directories, deploying additional scripts, establishing C2, removing existing cron jobs, and a lot more. The persistence mechanisms that Outlaw uses, they look for and terminate competing malware processes, which I thought was interesting. I can't really remember a time I've seen that, but I'll touch on that more in a second. Verifying the bash PID is running, and if it's not, it will execute run commands to start it. Deploying a modified version of XMRig, which is a cryptocurrency miner. Utilizing Stealth Shellbot for remote control via IRC channels. It changes the user profile passwords to aid in that persistent access. It does employ the Blitz module, which is the thing that is used for the SSH brute force, but it will deploy that inside of the compromised network to kind of further move laterally. It makes this malware sort of wormable, if that's the right term to use. They kind of reference that in the article, so I'll stick with it. And it'll cycle that attempt to do that lateral movement within those local subnets every 3 hours, which I thought was also kind of an interesting little point. It'll also perform post-execution cleanup, so removing temporary and other log files before it'll repeat its entire cycle. So some additional notes. The malware, as its objective, is crypto miner based, will also modify configurations that target the CPU on the affected systems to control the CPU thread count given to the miner itself. A few days after infection, Elastic noticed a manual remote login too, which is another little nugget in this, which was part of one of their honeypots that they watched and observed this activity. And they seen that in that login, there were manual commands being run. They were able to identify this because there was typos in the commands, and then there was quickly control C sent, which kind of gave them the verification that this was a manual login. And the primary goal seemed to be to upload a newer version of that malware, and they were leveraging wget to retrieve that file. The data actually also occurs. So after gathering system data around the IP, user info, CP architecture, and all of that, they would exfil that data to their C2, and really. This write-up had a lot of technical detail in it. There's a lot of depth there. I didn't touch on, in my summary, some of the points, but one thing I did find real interesting, Scott, is that this malware seems to hit like every high-level tactic of the MITRE matrix. I thought that was kind of cool. I know we've seen that before. I just thought it was worth pointing out because anyone that's wanting to understand how these attacks work or just kind of like trying to see like a hunt from top to bottom. I know myself when I was a younger analyst, one of the hard things with connecting the dots of understanding how to do stuff in this sector was to actually see the thing. Cause a lot of times as a defender, you're not actually seeing the full throttle piece, right? Like let's say you're a SOC analyst as an example, and you're watching, you're reacting to certain things. You generally have some level of procedures or guidance on how to react to that thing, but you're not seeing the full picture. So I kind of like when Intel gives you a bit of that whole top down to where you can kind of like really see it. And not all attacks fit that profile, right? But when you get those ones that you can see the initial access all the way through the impact phase, right? All of the tactics touched on and what they did in some level of detail in each one. It's really cool. I think it's really educational. But beyond that, Scott, what did you think about this one?
Yeah, so the big thing that you know, I like about Linux attacks is that once you start to understand and get comfortable with Linux, it kind of becomes a more simpler operating system as far as what adversaries typically have to do. And what I also like was, like you said, there's so much activity. And I think one of the reasons why it hit so many things in the MITRE is they've kind of made it a wormable attack, but they made it based on credentials. So there's a lot of activity that has to go on to constantly kind of do recon, also find credentials and then see what they can touch. But, you know, just some of the consistent things that, you know, I think are very common in a lot of attacks on the Linux systems. One, I've mentioned previous times before, but having to chmod payloads, right? So chmod is your, you know, is a modifier to the file to add like execution privileges and things like that. So obviously anything you move that you want to execute, you have to change that flag. So it's very common after you some payload or something gets moved to basically kick off that payload if you're not just doing everything natively from bash. The other thing for the persistence perspective, you know, leveraging crontab, which is basically like kind of like your scheduled task for the system, is, you know, that they're using that here. There is some, you know, pkill and kill commands, right? So it's just to kind of kill some things. And usually when you see those in succession, it's usually not a normal sign, because if someone's troubleshooting or trying to restart something, they're not just, you know, doing a swath of things. So I think that's like a good clear indicator for interesting stuff. And then the other thing that I also noticed that I liked, because you don't see this that often, but it's a very effective technique. And that's where they shattered the SSH file. Basically, there's extended attributes. And if the tool is called, it's chatter, C-H-A-T-T-R. But what it effectively lets you do is you can basically put restrictive permissions on something. So even if you're root, you can't actually edit or delete or do things with that file. You actually have to use chatter to then remove those permissions. But a lot of people don't know about that. So a really nasty way to stay persistent, especially if there is going to be any kind of like EDR type solutions on, you can basically use chatter to block a lot of that stuff. And they specifically use it by moving in their SSH key. So they can authenticate and kind of create that persistence from that backdoor perspective. And then they made that key, they chattered it, so it could be modified or removed by anybody. So it would just basically easily persist. So I thought that was also a really good technique they used that is used typically in that fashion as well. But yeah, it's just, you know, a lot of typical Linux things, you know, using some hidden directories in the home directory with the dot before the naming convention, you know, moving things to temp for initial execution. But yeah, you know, like I said, once you get comfortable with Linux, looking at all this activity, it's not nothing I haven't seen before. And it's kind of nice because you can see it all together in one story.
Yep. Very true. All right. What do you got next for us, Scott?
So I'm going to jump into an article from G-Data Cyber Defense. It's titled Smoked Out, a Mentol Spread Smoke Loader Malware. So what I liked about this was it's kind of a common trend of how a lot of the initial attacks are happening, or, you know, a common technique being leveraged. And that is using shortcut files, right? And this is a good example. So they are, especially when there is execution or infection chains, what I like is if there's multiple steps in an infection chain and it really just deals with the like the initial activity, not like the activity that's associated after the infection, it usually is a good sign there's something you can look for there. In this case, there's like five stages before it actually gets smoke loader running. But they basically they zip up a payload, very common. I'm assuming it was encrypted. I didn't necessarily see that. But when you pull it down, it has some bait files like you'd expect, because someone's expecting when they unzip something to have something of importance. So it looks like a PDF file, but then they have the LNK that once they open actually runs PowerShell to pull down a payload and then launch MSHTA. So it's pulling down an HTA file or getting MSHTA to actually, it's pulling down the file that MSHTA is going to target components of the file. So one thing that's really interesting is the modified version of the DCCW It's a built-in Windows utility for like the display color calibration wizard. But in this way, they've injected malicious code into it. And so when they are able to extract that code and use MSHTA to execute it, it basically runs an HTA script, which is like a web app script. And then that runs a couple of malicious JavaScripts. And so even that nature, when you look at the infection chain and that process execution, when you have PowerShell being launched and then it's launching MSHTA, sometimes that is kind of more suspicious in most cases. So looking at that, I think is very telling. Obviously, when it's running PowerShell, it is running encoded commands. So you're looking for, it's using a hidden windows and encoded commands. So, you know, very common technique, and especially when it runs PowerShell with a no profile loading, which is basically -NOP, N-O-P. It's a common thing, argument thrown in there with malicious PowerShell that's kind of want to be hidden just to perform a few key things. And you see this kind of activity, they even comment on there, like this activity, especially the stuff they saw with the fetching of files via PowerShell is similar to BlueStealer as well as Luma. And they comment on that as well. And then obviously the ending payload that they were looking to drop in this attack was SmokeLoader. So, you know, it was a kind of a predictable chain. I think a good approach to a lot of attacks that we see just kind of in the wild for a lot of the commodity-based stuff, especially. But you'll see the LNK tricks, even with some of the nation-state attacks, to initially kick off and, you know, basically start the chain to go whatever direction they're planning on going. But the LNK starting PowerShell with some of the typical PowerShell script commands launching other command line interpreters usually is a good sign that something bad's going on. So, yeah, I don't know. What did you think when you looked at this?
So one of the takeaways I had from it, and I've seen this recently a couple times where Intel reports are kind of specifying, you know, giving the evidence of this or the samples of this. So I remember way back in the day, especially starting out, I tend to talk this way because I think it's nice to revisit like those things or help anyone that's might be in those kind of struggles. You know, being an analyst and looking at an investigation or trying to understand what I'm looking at or digging through data, digging through logs to see X, Y, or Z. One of the things that I thought this article did really well is points out some of the ways to be able to identify, you know, more artifacts out of, say, a malicious document. So what I'm getting at is in here, they actually, you know, demonstrate the files that are dropped to kind of appear as like legitimate banking documents. And then you can just, you know, I don't know how many people are doing this. I know it's not necessarily something I jumped to when I was starting out or I was earlier on. But they, you know, take a look at the properties of the file and you can kind of see like the target or URL based, literally telling you what it's doing. Like it's pulling down X, Y, or Z. I know in a lot of times when you're in the heat of an investigation or looking at, you know, trying to connect the dots in your data, you might look to see what chained off that process. So this document did X and then you want to see what started from X, Y, and Z. And while that's not a negative, I just thought it was pretty cool that they really pointed that out in detail. Something probably should have called out in other times that we've seen that, but you get what I'm saying there, Scott. I think it's very interesting. Yeah, I think something that people tend to not think about.
I think it's always really important, especially in a lot of the articles or research papers or whatever, to pay attention to screenshots, because sometimes mm-hmm. there's things in the screenshots or images that are provided that don't get commented specifically on because the information is kind of presented already. And so a lot of times I've come up with interesting ideas for, you know, finding activity or even having ideas to defend against certain things by just taking something out of a screenshot and be like, oh, well, what is this? Is really weird. They didn't talk about this, but this looks weird to me. What is this actually doing? And doing a little further research and discovering that, oh, that's actually really unique to this. So, yeah.
Yeah. And if this is an echo of the other part, another piece that I thought was unique-ish out of this that I thought was interesting, maybe something to consider as a note to look at other times, but the use of the dccw.exe, which is the display color calibration wizard, it's a built-in Windows utility, and they were leveraging that to act as the loader for the malicious scripts, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I didn't comment on it, but usually when people are doing things like that, that's the biggest indicator. If it's a well-known Windows binary, it's not going to exist in weird locations. It's going to be in mm-hmm. the sys file or system 32 directories. So just knowing that if you see any kind of Windows utilities outside of their home, essentially, it's a good indicator that, hey, this doesn't look normal. What is interacting with this? And then by just asking that question, a lot of times you'll discover some things. So,
yeah, for sure. Taking a peek at it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. What do you got for us?
All right. Jumping into my next item of the week. So this one's a couple weeks out, but you know, we haven't been here for a couple weeks for various reasons. So I thought it was worth talking about and bringing up for a couple reasons. So this is a cybersecurity advisory from CISA about Medusa ransomware. So quick overview, Medusa ransomware, ransomware is a service variant first identified in June of 2021, and it's been around for quite a bit. And as of February 2025, Medusa developers and affiliates have impacted over 300 victims from a variety of critical infrastructure sectors. So we're talking medical, education, legal, insurance, technology, manufacturing, you know, Bob's your uncle. And just as a note, Medusa ransomware variant is unrelated to the Medusa Locker, or the variant of that that's on mobile. So the Medusa mobile malware, it's worth mentioning. So this advisory is pretty solid as it walks through in good detail some of the behaviors and how Medusa ransomware executes in the various tactic areas. I think the way this write-up is laid out is beneficial to hunters looking to add to their hunts around, you know, really the specific ransomware, just in general, looking at some of the common things, because it gives really good details that you could leverage to search for. So we see a lot of relatively common techniques used. So a lot of things that we talk about all the time. So PowerShell encoded commands, PowerShell commands running in hidden windows, the various use of Windows Management Instrumentation or WMI, PS exec to laterally move, changes to local firewalls to allow for additional functionality like remote WMI connections, registry edits to allow RDP, the use of Mimikatz to do LSAS dump for CRUD harvesting and more things along those lines, just as a couple. But I'll put this in air quotes, newer techniques pointed out. This is relative more to the Medusa ransomware, I think. Not necessarily net new in general, because we've seen versions of this stuff in different areas for sure. But the use of the CERT utility to avoid detection when performing file ingress. The use of public scan tools. So the two that are pointed out specifically are advanced IP scanner and soft perfect network scanner, leverage for enumeration, of course, and the use of R clone for exfil. And that's just a couple. But all in all, I wanted to point this one out because I spent some time in this one. I like this write-up for a lot of different reasons. I like the detail that's in there. I like some of the examples that are given. They're really simple to digest. It's uniformly put together, and it's easy to operationalize off of, I think, personally. But, you know, I'm curious what you thought.
No, I can definitely second that. What I really liked, one, it has all the details for multiple teams, right? I feel like they've got enough depth to understand, you know, who this actor is and kind of what their methodology is with some background. I like how they do put their kind of like hyperlinks or whatever to MITRE stuff throughout and all the CVEs throughout. So it's easy to pivot if you're interested in anything specific there. They do a really good job highlighting on what they think to prioritize on. And I think the things they call it are noteworthy. But yeah, it's what I think is also interesting too, is here you have another ransomware group and it's leveraging basically a lot of the common techniques other ransomware groups utilize that I've seen, like for instance, CERT util to move payloads, PowerShell encoded commands, and then the scanner stuff that you mentioned as well. And, you know, even using, you know, PS exec for lateral movement, and remote desktop, WMI, you know, focusing on those types of things and the registry keys you change or the firewall rules you update. Also very, very common in R clone, obviously, exfiltration, it's very common shared across the groups. The one thing though, that really stood out as something unique to me. I'm not sure if I've seen this before, was there how they obfuscated some of their PowerShell commands. I've seen where you use variables, right, to store certain things in variables, and you can use those variables to kind of concatenate or build your commands. But when storing the data in the variable, they did it in a way where they broke up the characters and then kind of add them together to make the words or the commands. And that level of obfuscation, I don't think I've seen, I'm familiar with it, but I can't remember the last time I've seen that. So that I thought was interesting and kind of noteworthy. And then also their use of, they basically use PowerShell to create a script block. And but the script block they're going to run is essentially going to be read into memory. And then they know that what they're reading in that's Base64 encoded is gzipped. So once they unzip it and then convert it back, they have the actual full script block that they're going to run. I thought that was interesting too. Like the, you know, it's another level of kind of obfuscation. It's not really encryption because you're just doing multiple different types of encoding and compression. But that mechanism itself, I think, is noteworthy because that's not a common thing I think you would see if you were looking at PowerShell activity across your environment. So that definitely would stand out. So yeah, like I said, there's a lot of really great mentions. I think everything you touched on and the you know few things I mentioned as well, I think make this a very identifiable group, but also I think also makes it easy to highlight how they relate to other ransomware groups as well.
Yeah, all good points. So yeah, the character replacement thing, I think I skipped over that a little too soon. That is actually interesting, but I kind of want to look at that a little more now. So that one's marked. All right, Scott, yeah, what do you got last for us this week?
So this is from Eastentire. I guess I'm saying that right. It's titled The Long and Short Cut of It, Koi Loader Analysis. Basically, this month, their threat response unit, they detected an intrusion using shortcut file. Like I mentioned, LNKs and shortcut files in the last article. Obviously, it's a very common technique, so it's being leveraged here as well. But they're basically loading a new version of Koi Loader. Basically, it's a malware that facilitates command and control. And they have a stealer component as well that leverages some advanced stealing and capabilities. Once again, this article provides a really good infection chain, and there's multiple steps. So when you see multiple steps in an infection chain, there's multiple opportunities to kind of pinpoint and stitch together things to look for. Similar fashion, though, a zip file. Last time it was 7-zip. This time it's just zip, but came across via email. There's an LNK inside. LNK also, once executed, is going to launch PowerShell. In this case, it's going to pull down JavaScript. And it also is going to create a scheduled task. That scheduled task is basically going to kick off WScript to then launch the JavaScript that was downloaded by that PowerShell, which will then later use PowerShell to delete the scheduled task. And then, you know, it copies itself and then disables, you know, AMC, which is, you know, the script defense component of Windows, downloads the rest of the Koi Loader, and then, you know, executes Koi Loader in the context of PowerShell. So PowerShell is actually launching it. So just looking at those steps alone, one, not a lot of people create scheduled tasks with PowerShell, but if someone's creating a scheduled task and then deleting a scheduled task, that's kind of an interesting sign because they're just leveraging that as a way to indirectly execute something. Where a lot of times I would say if PowerShell launched WScript, that would be very suspicious because it's kind of a script interpreter to a script interpreter type behavior. But in this case, they're going through scheduled tasks to kind of break up that chain. So, you know, interestingly enough, worth paying attention to. This one also has similar screenshots where you can kind of see some of the data within the target line of the LNK. And they walk through some of the PowerShell stuff. It's got a similar obfuscation, like I mentioned before, where they're actually doing the breakup of the string. And now that I'm looking at it, I'm not sure if it's the same breakup or not. Let me double check that real quick. No, it's not the same way because they basically broke up download file string, but they didn't break it up exactly the same. They used different combinations of letters within their quotes before they're adding it up. But they same technique though, right? Where they're putting things in quotes, adding them to concatenate that into a variable, kind of to help bypass some of the detection or string-based detection activity. So just looking for that behavior, but they do it a lot in a lot of their scripting. My guess is it's not like they doing it when I say it that way. My guess is they are using a obfuscation tool to run their stuff through, and that's kind of how it outputs and obfuscates things. That's very common as well, especially from these, I would call them a lower tier actor. Just it's like easy mode, right? And that one of the things they do, and I don't really pay attention to this that much, but I think it's a good thing to pay attention to, is they basically read the registry key, which is in the local machine hive software, Microsoft cryptography machine good. I wouldn't expect a lot of things read that key. And one of the things you see, especially when it comes to info stealers or things that land that need to collect information in general before they do further activity, I think this key actually gets touched a fair amount from that activity. So it's worth knowing what reads it. And then you can probably do some exclusions, and that'd be a good indicator. Like, why is there, especially if it's a weird process that you've never seen, read it, kind of pay attention to. Trying to think if there's any other things that I was going to highlight here. But yeah, that's kind of the gist of the things I would focus on. They go into a lot of activity as far as after the fact, but they have a lot of things where they're looking for a lot of common usernames that are probably in sandbox environments, a lot of common host names that are probably associated with sandbox environments. So the one thing that's notable about this group is they're very well aware of like the defense sandbox environments to help prevent their stuff from being auto-analyzed. So that's just something to take note of, that that they have a lot of anti-analysis tools, but not based on key processes and things, more so on the identifying characteristics of the host itself. But yeah. So what's your thought?
So kind of fun. First, before I dive into the fun part, I did want to echo again, there's a nice little snapshot where it shows the LNK file, and it shows kind of like that target area having the script command run, and then shows the start in to establish itself as a scheduled task, right? It was pretty cool. Again, worth noting, worth looking at. The evasion section was really interesting. So you mentioned it already, but yeah, you generally and typically see when there's like sandbox evasion, usually targeting things like Hyper-V, VMware, VirtualBox, things like that. But a couple new ones to me, Parallels, Display Manager, Red Hat, QXL Controller, hadn't necessarily seen those. So those were kind of cool to see. Some of the other things that it did, I had questions on, really. So I'm going to kind of aim them at questions to you to see if you digested it in a way that made more sense. So I'm trying to understand the layer for the evasion tactics. Are they like tokens or what? So one specifically, where they talk about the user directory or desktop directory is checked for a couple log files. So it's like resource.txt, openvpn.txt. And inside of it, it's just a 4-bit size file that contains the string bait, B-A-I-T. And then another one was check for file newsongs.txt in the same desktop directory. And if the file is found, and it checks to ensure that the file is 0x37 bytes. If so, it checks for the string Jennifer Lopez and Pitbull on the floor and Beyonce Halo. And then you go even farther when it's looking at the different username stuff, and it's like kind of, it has these like username matches. So my first notion, and then even like to check the computer names to make sure they match X, Y, or Z. I was curious what you thought of those, Scott. Like, do you identify those as like tokens to say, you know, we have this layer of foothold, like checkpoints to look for to make sure X, Y, or Z is good to go before going to the next stage? Or these like misdirection nuggets? I'm just curious what you thought of these, because I didn't really understand the context of them, but I am very interested in why it's doing this.
Yeah, so they basically have profiled a lot of the open source sandbox things. When you look at like any run or look at whatever, I'm kind of blanking on Joe Sandbox or different sandbox environments for their basic deployment. Because if you know anything about sandbox environments, once you run malware in it, it just snaps back to a previous snapshot. So there's a level of consistency every time that box is basically turned on, ready to execute something. And these are artifacts that when they built that sandbox, they have identified through either their testing or their processes. So now what they do is they look for these artifacts, and they know they're in those types of environments. Like the user documents, the sandbox may have created these. Obviously, I think the biggest indicator is openvpn.txt and resource.txt. And we're inside of it just says bait. Basically, they, in the sandbox environment, created these files as really just bait, and they probably have them monitored to see if anyone touches them, right? Because if anyone touches them, then they can say, oh, look, because OpenVPN text might, people might be looking at for like keys to VPNs and things like that. And then like the random things with the Jennifer Lopez and Pitbull stuff, like I'm assuming there are files with like TXTs and docx that are created on a system, because some ransomwares, for instance, target specific extensions. And if you don't have those key extensions, because your box is basically naked, so it's just holding executables and that's it, and system files, nothing's going to get encrypted. So you kind of have to have files like this that could be touched. So you know, like, for instance, the new songs.txt, no one's going to care about it. But if you run ransomware that encrypts TXTs, that file will get touched, right? So like you kind of make it even a weird file in that aspect, so that you know that it was touched because of that type of behavior. So it's like from the sandbox. And you can tell even from like the FortiPC, I'm assuming it's associated with the Fortinet sandbox PC. So some of these things are called out. And even like the, you know, the desktop ET51AJO, that is, you know, common Windows naming for desktops. But like I said, once you snapshot a PC for a sandbox, that is the PC from that point forward. So that's kind of like the technique that they're leveraging here is, like I said, I think they just profiled a lot of environments. So they know not to run, essentially, right? They give away anything. So it's interesting because it kind of tells you where they've been, right? And kind of their development process, at least what sandboxes that, you know, they're aware of. So, you know, there, if you know of a sandbox that doesn't have these artifacts, then it might be a good place to test things in a sandbox environment, you know, as an example. But yeah, so that's kind of why it's an interesting list for them to pull it out. I've seen things like this before, but not this extensive.
Yeah, it seemed to be a lot of different techniques to do the evasion specifically around sandboxing. Like, I think I'm assuming, again, you know, not direct context, but the checking, like another example, the checking to determine if the machine has more than 3 gigs of physical memory, right?
I can see that as being a check. Those are the common things that they are looked for, like system specs or specific processes. But that's like the thing that most people look for when they create, you know, you look at rules where, oh, it was profiled to see if it was in a VM. You know, it's like a YARA signature, or it's like a signature on the system when you get the report back. Well, I think they're trying to evade those rules. So when they run things, they know it's not, that doesn't pop up, because sometimes that might be the only indicator that something weird's going on. Like, why would it be profiling? And if they profile this way, they avoid all those other identification markers and still achieve the same goal. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, it was fun to kind of look at that evasion piece. Cause it was like, hey, wait, why are they doing this? And there was an extensive amount of, how do we get around sandboxes? So. Pretty cool.
I think that kind of sums everything up this week. So I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing up next week. And with that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of March 31st, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.